Members, thanks for your patience. We're trying to get back in the mode here of 8:15 in the morning after last couple of later nights. Again, thanks to the staff, we were able to deliver the bill before 8 o'clock to meet the timeline required. So not sure. I haven't got to ask them how late they stayed. I'm actually feeling too guilty to ask them. Members, we'll bring the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. Today we just have one item on the agenda. It's House File 1262. It's Representative Ward's bill. Due to his family medical situation, Representative Purcell will fill in ably for Representative Ward. Representative Purcell is a co-author on the bill. We Representative Ward and his family in our thoughts and prayers. Representative Purcell, we've allowed the whole committee time. With the weather in a lot of the Lake Country, there may be some folks that are not going to get a chance potentially. So we're working with the Cabin Owners Association and Lake people. This bill has to go to a couple more committees. I believe our motion will, or your motion, Representative Purcell, will be to send it to public safety, and I think then it's got to also go to judiciary. But we will retain the right to bring it back here as we work with those chairs if the need is there for additional comment from the public on something in or not in the bill. So hopefully we'll be able to just keep moving through the process, because this does have some day after enactment clauses that are really important as we prepare for opening day. And I really appreciate Representative Purcell. You taken this. So with that, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 1162 as you described.
Your motion, Representative Purcell, would be for House File 1162 to pass and be referred to public safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the bill, and I just a few introductory comments, and Commissioner Meyer is with me here, and he's going to explain more of the details and likely answer more of the questions. I would just say to the committee that this bill is an effort to provide some new tools in our effort to get a handle on some aquatic invasive species and try and improve our mechanisms for dealing with a lot of these aquatic invasive species. There's some new inspection requirements in here. There's training in here, and some permitting is in here, and maybe some things that, you know, we talk about what we do and don't want our state government to be doing. But certainly, this is an instance where we need to have our diligent state employees working hard. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Meyer. Any questions right away, I'd try and do my best to answer, but otherwise I'll turn it over for discussion of the bill. And Mr. Meyer, if you want to, any explanations.
Welcome, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm just going to say a few introductory comments and turn this over to Dr. Skinner, who is going to be doing the walkthrough of the bill and answering your questions today. First and foremost, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for hearing this important issue today. This is the culmination of a stakeholder process that is the phase two process that we spent the interim working with a group of concerned citizens representing a bunch of different interests. The issue before us today is, as we've said in the past, second only to the budget. The issues that we're facing, this is the primary issue the DNR has to face with to try to solve this year. The bill, some people will tell you, probably doesn't go far enough. Some people will tell you it goes too far. But we need to be proactive on these issues and make sure that we are trying to educate and make sure that people know what their actions may or may not do, and that we give them the opportunity to clean their boats when they are contaminated or when they do come out of an infested water, and we have the authority to inspect and also teach people what the best management practices are. The spread of Eurasian water milfoil that we've been dealing with is one issue, but now the threat that we face with zebra mussels and some of these lakes and the movement of boats from these lakes because of our fishing and our enjoyment and dedication to our water recreation activities has some big concerns. So you're going to hear from people that some of this stuff in our bill may be crazy. You guys are nuts trying to do this, but we need to do whatever we can to make sure that we're doing the best we can. We don't want to say, well, we should have done something different. We want to take this proactively and be as strong as we can and as fast as we can, and we appreciate all of your support in doing that. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm going to have Dr. Skinner come up and walk through the bill and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Welcome, Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. As Commissioner Meyer talked about...
Dr. Skinner, if you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the DNR's Invasive Species Program within the Division of Ecological and Water Resources.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. As we just stated, there's some key things to this bill. Some of them are new policy changes, and some of them are some technical changes just to clean up what some of the past legislation has included. And as we mentioned, there's going to be enhanced inspections and enforcement authorities, increased penalties for violations for aquatic invasive species laws, required training for lake service providers, some required education for watercraft owners and operators, and a streamlined permitting and invasive species aquatic plant management activities. Mr. Chairman, if you like, I can start walking through the bill.
Please do, Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, sections 1 through 7 are definitions, and some of them are new, including defining inspection, and also one to pay close attention to is in section 6, a definition for water-related equipment. And this will play a key important role as we move through the language, because previously it was related to boating-related equipment only, and now water-related equipment is much broader. It provides a much more broad description of those things that go into the waters of the state. And that will play a role as we come down through some of the language. Those are two of the key ones. So water-related equipment means motor vehicle, boat, watercraft, dock, boat lift, raft, vessel, trailer, tool, and many other things like that that can contain water or harbor invasive aquatic invasive species. Again, prior to that, we were only talking about boats and specifically in the prior. As you move on into Section 8, an annual report, this allows some consolidation of two reports, an annual report and a report on prevention measures, so little consolidations of reports. In Section 9, again, this is one of those technical changes and one of those things we already do right now. This would require that nets that are used for bait harvest are only used in infested waters and they cannot be used in other waters. We already do that by permit, but this way it puts it into legislation that if you're using, for example, nets in Mille Lacs to harvest bait in the spring, that you cannot take them to uninfested waters in the future. They have to have a second set of nets or different nets for that purpose.
Dr. Skinner, to that point, how do we know? Are they required to tag them?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they have to tag them. We provide training, and they are all tagged, and they're tagged specifically for where they are harvesting for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next section I want to bring your attention to as we move through the bill is aquatic macrophytes and transport. If you go on to pay let's take you down to line 5.23 on page 5. When removing water-related equipment from waters, the state for purposes of cleaning off aquatic macrophytes or leaving water access, currently the law, if you pull out, as the way it's, if we, the way we have it written now, is that we need to give you authority to actually pull the water out and move it before you can clean it. So, again, a technical change just to allow people to actually leave the water body to the access to clean. Otherwise, the current law would make it too restrictive. You can't even do that. So a technical cleanup.
Mr. Chair, to that point, could, would you...
Fabian.
I'm sorry. Could you give me that section again, please, Mr. Skinner?
Dr. Skinner.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, right now I'm looking at on page 5, it'd be line 5.23, under subdivision 2 on exceptions.
Thank you.
Dr. Skinner, so an example, someone on Ossawinna McKee pulls out their raft, and it's got zebra mussel on it. Currently, they're supposed to remove the zebra mussel while it's still in the water, and you're going to allow them at the landing to remove it, or if you could expand on that.
Mr. Chairman, there's two parts to that. Yes, one is if you pull a dock out right now, and then you put it back, there's two parts. This one allows, it says, removing water-related equipment from waters of the state for the purpose of cleaning off aquatic macrophytes for leaving water access. So this is an exception. We want to allow you to pull the boat out so you can then clean it before you, you know, on that access before you leave it. Right now it says when leaving waters of the state. So we got to let you get out of the water to be able to clean it before you can leave. Mr. Chairman, there's another provision coming up that also says if you pull your dock out, if you're on infested waters like Lake Ossawinamakee, and you pull your dock out and it has zebra mussels attached to it, but you're going to put it back in the next spring, that you're not in violation of the law as well.
Thank you, Dr. Skinner. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next one I bring your attention to is Section 14, line 6.12. This section here is important to note. This was the drain plug law of last year, which required you to drain all water from your boats and from your live wells and your bilges. The one thing that was exempted last year was portable bait containers. With the new definition of water-related equipment and the way this is currently worded, it would now include portable bait containers. So you would be required to drain your portable bait container before leaving any water of the state. It doesn't mean that you can't keep your bait, but it means that you have to exchange your water at that point. Then you'd have to dump your water, then put in fresh water before you leave to ensure that you're not spreading aquatic invasive species.
Dr. Skinner, I'm going to ask you to walk through how that actually works for somebody coming to the boat landing with bait, and what? How would they meet this law with getting to keep their bait?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, currently, right now, on zebra mussel and spiny water flea infested waters, you're required to exchange your water, empty your bait container before you leave the access. Most anglers now, on Mille Lacs, for example, if they want to continue to save their bait, they bring water with them. They bring it, keep it in a cooler, keep cool water. And so when you come off the landing, especially if you're, it doesn't matter if it's been in the water or not, you were just required to drain. So you drain your bait bucket and then you put in fresh water prior to leaving. And so anglers are learning to do that, whether you keep frozen water in your truck and bring it out or have it in a cooler.
Dr. Skinner, are we considering at some of the high traffic boat landings this spring, when we're manning them with DNR or assistance, some of the programs you have, do we ever have thought about the possibility of those folks having some clean water to accommodate people with expensive bait having to be thrown away? Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we haven't done that to date, but it's something we can certainly consider. As you're right, there would be a lot. We'd hope that this would be a personal responsibility. For example, we met with Fravo, a company who actually makes bait containers, and they're actually making duplicate containers now with nets that go inside. So if you come off an infested water, you don't have to take it out, but you actually just remove the net, drain it, and you place it into your other container, which is ready to go with fresh water. So they're looking at options like that as one of those things. This current bill, or the new proposed language, would require you to do this from leaving all waters of the state, infested or not, at this point.
Dr. Skinner, are they thinking about putting some warnings right on the bait containers? Have you had discussions with them about something about the red circle line through it, about moving water and such? I would think the bait buckets themselves could be an education tool.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that's a good idea. If this goes into effect statewide, we would have to do more education on it, and that could be one avenue to do that.
Representative Deal.
Thank you, Chairman Agmer. Dr. Skinner. On the bait buckets, on like the minnow bucket, when you pour the water out, it's got the door on it with holes in it, you pour it out. What about the spiny water flea? Can't they continue to attach themselves where the little holes are and things like that, and don't go out of the minnow bucket at all, and then you put the fresh water in and you still have the spiny water flea in there?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, they could. Part of this bill is to do is to reduce risk. Sometimes it's, you know, we can't see them, right? We can't always see the spiny water fleas everywhere we go, and so trying to decontaminate a bait bucket in some cases is very difficult. But what we can do is reduce the risk by having to do this drain. Last year, the portal bait container was actually pulled out because it was a concern of folks, but we want to put it back in because we think it's a big enough issue. So, yes, you could do that, but if you drain and wash, you're going to reduce that risk significantly by doing that.
Representative Deal.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Continue, Dr. Skinner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this, again, Section 14 would be a particular place to pay close attention. In this section, we also allow for emergency response vehicles and equipment to transport on public roads with the drain plug in after they've drained all the water from their equipment before leaving a site. So if you have a water patrol who has to go from one lake to another because of an emergency, that as long as they pull their plug, drain it, and they put it back in before they leave, that is fine. We want to give them that option to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Skinner, you're saying other than emergency vehicles, a normal non-emergency vehicle couldn't do that under the bill?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski. The law currently is that way. You have to have your baler or your plug pulled while transporting on public roads right now, and this would continue on.
Thank you,
Dr. Skinner. To that point, so normally a CO would be no different than the regular fisherman. They would pull their plug when they leave, unless it was an emergency situation.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Right now, they would have to comply, but this allows them after they drain to put it back in. For the fear of launching right away in an emergency situation, that they're not going to sink their boat. So, but yes, right now they have to pull the plug as well.
So, Dr. Skinner, the normal boat needs to have the plug pulled as they're driving around. So, if a conservation officer, peace officer saw somebody with the plug in their boat, that would be reason to pull them over because you're not supposed to. Is that only when you leave infested waters or any boat traveling anywhere?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it is illegal to have it on from any waters of the state. So you have to have your drain device out while you're transporting or driving on a public road. And so typically you see the process as people come into the public access, they stop, and the first thing they do is they put their plugs back in. Our watercraft inspectors are now trained to make sure they remind boaters to put them back in, because that does happen now and again.
Dr. Skinner, do you think that some of us have forgotten that once in a while?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. We've been hearing some stories from last summer of
boats. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Skinner, if I have my boat at home and it's a week after I was last on the water and I pull out of the garage and put the boat plug into the boat, I'm on my way out to the river, I'm in violation at that point. Is that correct?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, current law says drain plugs, balers, valves, and other devices used to control the drain of water from ballast waters, bilges, live wells must be removed and opened while transporting on a public road. That's the current law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwong.
Mr. Chair, you alluded to this being a primary offense. In other words, you can be stopped for a primary offense. If it's not a primary offense, they are not able to stop you unless there's another cause. So, just clarification.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, Representative, to your question, currently it would be considered a primary offense, so they could a conservation officer or any law enforcement officer could pull somebody over if their drain plug was not removed.
And Major Smith, that's current law, because I've had calls about that, and I've had to, as one of the co-authors of that bill, defend what I think is the right thing. But it does take for a mind change for people that it's against the law to have the drain plug in your boat all the time, basically, until you get to the landing. And for those of us that have forgotten to put the plug in, that we used to just worry about that the first time in the spring, it's a different responsibility now. Continue, Dr. Skinner. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. Major Smith, a primary offense, is that petty, a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, what is a primary offense in terms of the penalty?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, it doesn't really have anything to do with the penalty. It has to do more with the ability of a peace officer to stop somebody. And let me draw an analogy. For years, it was not a primary offense to be not wearing your seatbelt. And a couple years ago, the legislature made it a primary offense, so if a peace officer saw somebody driving without a seatbelt, they could stop them for that violation. Prior to that, if you saw somebody driving down the road without their seatbelt on, they'd have to be stopped for speeding or something else. So it wouldn't be a primary offense where they could stop somebody just for not wearing their seatbelt.
Representative Dill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then what is the level of penalty if they're cited? Is that a petty misdemeanor then?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, everything in 84D except for a couple items in the penalty section of the chapter are all misdemeanors.
Okay, thank you.
Major Smith, what would you say as a policy if you saw somebody driving down the road getting close to the boat landing and you saw that their plug was already in? What would be a couple different possible scenarios to take?
Mr. Chair, members, it'd be you got to kind of look at the totality of the circumstances, I guess. If you saw a boat, and it was dripping water and was headed towards the access, that might be a primary offense, or that might be something to stop the boat. But if it's the fishing opener and it doesn't look like the boat's ever been in the water, or the CO might be on another call, or the peace officer might be on another call, I guess it's kind of hard to capsulize that kind of at this time. But I apologize, I can't really do that right now.
Major, if you don't mind, if you could just get, I'd be curious to know if you have any records of how many folks you have actually written tickets and penalized in the last year. It's a brand new regulation, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know how many people actually had tickets written up as they approached the landing with a plug in? And were there cases where there actually was water behind the plug, or were there cases where you find somebody with a dry boat just because the plug was in?
Mr. Chair, members, this was brand new last year, and we'll probably get into this a little bit more when we talk about penalties. But when a law is enacted, before it can be put on the statewide payables list, it has to go through the Council of Judges. So last year when this was enacted and it went through as a law, there was no penalty provision in the bail schedule for conservation officers or any peace officer to write this a person a ticket and give them the fine, and they could pay the fine. It would have been mandatory court. And most of the time when we have a new law like this, pull the plug, we actually sent out direction to our folks that this is a good opportunity for education. You have other tools, you have verbal warnings, written warnings that you can give folks, because we didn't want to start sending people for mandatory court appearances for not pulling their plug. So we actually did get it, I believe, on the bail schedule last year, so that a person could actually be given if they were given a citation, they could pay it like a speeding ticket where they'd know the fine and they could pay that fine. So I'm kind of going around a little bit on your question. We didn't write a lot prior to, I think, at all last year, because it just kind of got on the payables January 1st. So the exact numbers, I can't really give you exact numbers. I don't have those exact numbers for this thing, but I could look that up for you, Mr.
Major, that would be good. I just wanted to make sure all the members of this committee were aware. This is just one of the things that's the reality of trying to control this. This is really serious stuff moving around, and it is an inconvenience, and for folks, it takes a change in your attitude of how this works, but I think it's definitely the correct direction. Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, last year there were 159 tickets written last year. 158 of those were civil citations. And so those could be for transport of aquatic plants on public roads, et cetera, for a variety of things. I don't have that broken down exactly what was for what, but there was one criminal citation given and 158 civil citations and over 350 warnings as well statewide.
Okay. If you could, Dr. Skinner, let us know if any of those were for not pulling the plug. That'd be great. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that somewhat answers my question, but looking at the penalty matrix here, you said you had to go to the court system because there wasn't a docket or whatever. Does the commissioner have broad authority with administrative penalties to provide for the? I mean, I'm kind of a little confused here of the authority that you have that you didn't have the administrative authority for doing the ticketing or notices of violation or warning. Is it the three-pronged approach and that the criminal was just something you had to do because the law was not specific enough?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, when we talk about penalties, the legislature is able to, and they'll set a specific crime, either petty misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, and then like a misdemeanor has a range of penalty of fine and jail time, okay? And in order for it to get put on a payables list, there is the state court administration that kind of shepherds this process through. And there's basically three main payable lists. There's that they call it the DNR one, which would be game and fish wrecked vehicle. There's traffic, which would be your speeding, seat belts, no tail lights, the majority of peace officers use. And there's also a commercial vehicle payables list for any commercial vehicle violations. You're a trucker, you don't have your weight, all that. So how the process works is we'll take a specific piece of law that is a violation, and about July or so of the year, we'll contact court administration and say, we would like to have this on the payables list, because then if the person's written a citation, they can pay it just like a speeding ticket. Otherwise, if it's not on the payables list, they have to go to mandatory court. And many times for these misdemeanors, they don't need to go to mandatory court. We don't need to clog up our judicial system any more than it is. So we will make recommendations to court administration. Conference of Judges, which is a group of judges, they meet in the early fall, they look at our recommendations, and then usually by January 1st of the year, they come up with the updated bail schedule. So that's kind of how the criminal part works. The civil part is where, and this we'll be getting into this later on in this bill, is the legislature has the authority to make something a civil crime, and then also the legislature sets that criminal amount, or that civil amount, excuse me. So you have the opportunity to set that civil amount, but anything criminally has to go through this conference of judges. So that's kind of that two-pronged approach. And in between there, we do have, or underneath them, we do have the ability to give people verbal warnings and written warnings. And of course, those don't have any fine ball to come. It's just, you know, don't do it. And the written warnings, some documentation. So that's basically the three or four tools if you want to consider the verbal warnings different. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you, Major. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major Smith, I was encouraged to hear you talk about this is a great opportunity for the DNR to do some education. And the sportsmen that I know and hunt, and in this case fish with, on Lake of the Woods care a lot about Lake of the Woods. I'm somewhat concerned, and I want to proceed cautiously about violations, warnings versus fines and so forth. I'm just encouraging you to make sure that the guys who've got their boots on the ground out there, who are the conservation officers, don't come across as being heavy-handed in these sorts of things. You have a tremendous obligation at this point, if this bill passes, to make sure that we do everything that we can to make sure that people are educated. You talked about the boat plug laws and so forth. I consider myself to be fairly involved and know about all these things. Quite honestly, I didn't know about that until now. So I just don't want this to come across as being heavy-handed. I want to make sure that we allow people to make an honest mistake and not get the book thrown at them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And that's kind of along my same line, too. I was going to ask kind of a generalized question to Major Smith. The people you stopped last year, the 158 or 59 citations, was it more a matter of just not knowing, or was there a I forgot type of thing, or what are you hearing? Are we doing a good enough job of getting the message out to people that this is a law now and they have to comply with it?
Major Smith, could you elaborate again on Dr. Skinner said there was 158 or 59. I think they included, for the most part, probably things other than the boat plug. Yeah. What would be some of the typical things they got stopped for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the education aspect is kind of interesting how this evolved. You know, we had 159 civil citations, one criminal citation last year. Prior to that, it was a lot less. And we started issuing citations and issuing civil citations last year. And it got to the point, in all seriousness, where people were getting their civil citation and they said, but you're supposed to warn me about this. You know, they knew, I mean, we've almost educated them to the point where we were educating them that they were going to get a verbal warning, you know. So when we started to actually issue some of these civil citations and the one criminal citation, it was a wake-up call for some folks. And I guarantee you, a state trooper could sit on a highway outside a small town and write 15 tickets to speeders. And not too many people would talk about it in the coffee shop, but a game warden can write one ticket to a person at the landing for something like this, and everybody in the coffee shop is going to talk about it. And sometimes we get calls from legislators on one citation. So we did start to write some of these citations, and what we did this year is we started developing work crews, where we'd get groups of conservation officers to work certain public accesses. And we started documenting the number of people we contacted versus the number of violations. And we ended up with these 240 work crews we held across the state last year, where we had a number of COs and we actually logged every single contact we had. We made 7,053 contacts, okay? We issued 128 citations, one criminal citation. We had 353 written warnings. So we had 707 verbal warnings. So when we go from the criminal, 128, where we're actually fining somebody, 128, 353 written warnings, 707 verbal warnings. We had a violation rate of 17%. So I think. And you'll see later on in the bill where we're proposing something about education, and we're actually, the DNR is actually saying that for the first year we're not going to write tickets for it. We're going to have it law where we're only going to write written warnings for it. So I think you can see we're taking a measured approach. We're not going to come off heavy-handed. We're trying to educate folks, and to be quite honest with you, some people need a ticket to get educated. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. Well, Major Smith, that one comment you made about that getting calls from legislators, I think I resemble that remark. But my question is, Major, is on the warnings, and this isn't specific to this bill, but on the warnings, do those get entered into the system so that if you do one at Captogama over at War Road, if the officer runs the license, driver's license, or the boat registration, it'll come up and the other officer knows that there's been a warning issued for the same thing?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, the warnings get entered into a system that we have at the DNR. and that information can be recalled, but currently our officers don't have that capability in the field. They'd have to go back to their computer at their house and run it and actually look for that individual to see and enter that individual's name in. There are records management systems out there that would allow for that, but DNR and DNR enforcement hasn't invested the money into that technology. In fact, later this afternoon, we're actually going over to the BCA to look at a records management system that might help us with that capability. Not for a cheap plug, but you know, everything costs money.
Right.
And so we need to look at it and weigh the options. And to be quite honest, it's been a issue in DNR enforcement that we've had some problems with in the past because they don't want to spend the money on it. So we need to find some type of alternative. So we're actually meeting with the BCA this afternoon.
Follow-up, Representative Deal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does that then flow out to the other where you actually write a ticket? Do you have the same problem on tickets that were written? For example, someone shoots from a roadway at Captogama, and then on War Road they get at least apprehended for a similar thing, and can the officer know that out in the field that that happened at another location?
Major Smith, can you give a short answer, and then I do want to allow Mr. Wagner's got to leave to testify. So if you could do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, same problem.
Thank you. Is that it, Representative Dill?
Yeah, that's it.
Mr. Wagner, you want to come forward. You're one of the citizens that wanted to testify, and I want to try to accommodate. If you could tell us who you are and who you represent and your thoughts on House File 1162.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Vern Wagner. I'm Vice President of Anglers for Habitat, which is a statewide hunting conservation group. I want to tell you first that Anglers for Habitat, on our board, we have members from the leadership members from Muskies, Inc., Bass Federation, Walleye. We have retired DNR fisheries. We have vetted all of this information in this bill with all of our members, and I haven't gotten any pushback. They feel like it's these are the tools that we need to have in our toolbox. I was on the Citizen Stakeholder Committee, and we really reviewed a wide range of options and synthesized those down. We feel like this what's being presented today is a plan. We do have. I want to tell you that we have a couple of folks who feel that we need to get the knowledge of the law out to non-residents who are bringing boats into Minnesota, that somehow we need to get perhaps some signage or something on the major routes in the Minnesota, like the signs that says if you're pulling a boat, these are the laws, or something out there for them. The second thing is some of the bait dealers are working with the DNR right now because they usually take the water from where they collect the bait and haul that, and so they need to come up with a process with the department to try to figure that out so that water doesn't get returned any place it shouldn't. And the third thing is that many of the fishing guides really want to comply with the rule, and they buy a large quantity of bait in the morning. What they've come up with is a cooler system where it has an internal recirculating system. They buy the bait, they put it in there, they use it. Now, they may go from lake to lake with that cooler, but the water in that cooler never comes in contact with any lake water. So they just want to make sure that they're able to have that cooler in their boat, move it from lake to lake, and it's well water, usually, that they get right where they buy the bait to fill the cooler. We're convinced that this information and these rules and new regulations are really on track to doing the education that needs to be done. The pull your plug law has been one of the best kept secrets out there, and we need to change that. This also gives the watercraft inspectors and conservation officers and law enforcement more authority to actually look in your live well. Right now, they can't even look in your live well to see if you've drained it. They can ask you, but they can't actually do it. This would give them some more latitude in doing some of that, and we believe that that's important. Yes, there will be people who don't like this, and they're probably the ones that will have to get a ticket. If there's any questions, I have to leave for a
questions for Mr. Wagner. Mr. Wagner, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dill, were you done? I wanted to comment, Mr. Wagner. Representative Dill.
On this, it just seems to me that that's a real problem, that, you know, we could issue a warning or even a ticket for something, and then later the same violator in another area. So I did actually have a one last follow-up question on this, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Major, do you have the authority that if the conservation officer does go back home and looks up this person that he just gave a warning to for this issue as an example, and then he finds out that some weeks ago he got a warning for the same thing in another area, then do you have the ability to go back and issue a citation?
Major.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, yes, we can dismiss the warning and issue the person a citation.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Dill and this officers not having the capability, and right when they're writing tickets, to know what a background is. You know, this is the reason we set up CRIMNET for other kinds of violators, because it turns out that it's a kind of a small group of folks who can repeat and repeat and repeat, and those are the folks you want to get at. It's not the person you give a warning to once and they say, oh, okay, I won't do that again, and they probably won't. It's a small group of people, and if we don't have the capability of getting at that small group of people who just don't give a rip, then we've really lost, we're losing the fight. So my basic question to you is, how much does the system cost that you're talking about?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I wish I had the meeting yesterday, because we're going to find out the cost today, this afternoon after lunch, but ballpark, $400,000 or less. You know, the technology's out there. We get water delivered to our office and by Culligan, and the Culligan water guy puts down the water, and he pulls out a little deal and punches in some stuff, and a receipt prints out, and they hand it to you, and off they go. And they can tell you how many gallons of water you've used, and they can tell you who signed for it last, and all that stuff. The technology's out there. It's just a matter of investing in it, and that's the difficult part.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, when you have your meeting and find that out, would you get back to the committee and let us know exactly what the price tag is of what the capability you need? I think, Mr. Chairman, if that's something we really do need to get our hands around.
It's a good idea, Representative Wagenius. Major, you'll get us that information after your meeting through Mr. Meyer, and he can send it to us. Dr. Skinner, continue.
Mr. Chairman, starting on next section 15, and this is all new language regarding around inspections. And so this is a pretty important section to talk about. In particular, we're talking part one, subdivision one, on line 7.1, page 7, is about compliance inspection. This is where it gives us the requirement to do it, where people will be required then to be inspected. So if we have an inspection station set up, and or we're at an access, then this would require that voter to be inspected. And it also would prohibit an individual who an inspector may prohibit an individual who refuses to allow inspection of this at the same point. So not only would you have the authority to do inspections, but also prohibit any launching of a boat if they refuse inspection. Subdivision 2 gives the authorities not only for conservation officers and local peace officers, but also authorized inspectors, which would be a new category that we currently do not have in the DNR, to have trained, authorized inspectors to do these inspections and then deny this access if they do not comply with the law. And Section C under Subdivision 2 also provides
conservation officers the ability to utilize check stations in locations to do these. So we could actually set up stations around the state or in areas they could be mobile, and that they can, when people come through, that they're required to stop and be inspected as required by this legislation. So this is a new piece that falls in that would be
Dr. Skinner, and I don't mean to, I just think in full disclosure, we need to have some of these tough discussions. Would this go back, Major Smith, to a DNR policy of years ago, sometimes on opening weekends, where, in this case, I'd imagine they'd need to be pulling a boat, but I can think of when I was younger, just beginning to hunt, that sometimes we'd be on our way home on a Sunday afternoon, is the way I always remember it, and the cars would be being all pulled over, and we called them game checks. I'd imagine these would be called boat checks. Are we potentially looking at that kind of a scenario?
Mr. Chair, members, yes and no. What you're talking about is checkpoints, and there was a decision called the Asher decision when it came to DWI checkpoints that basically made them unconstitutional and illegal. We've worked with the AG's office to talk about our game and fish checkpoints, and part of the Asher decision, and I'm just going to give the Reader's Digest version, I'm not an attorney, was some of the issues were that there was the violation rate wasn't high enough. You're getting too many people that weren't impaired coming through the checkpoint. So we worked with the Attorney General's office through that Asher decision, and we do some game and fish checkpoints, but we very carefully pick the location. For example, we would pick a location for a game and fish checkpoint on a road that comes right off of Red Lake, so that we can show that the majority of the vehicles that are coming down this road are coming from Red Lake, because there's no other road other than the ice road coming off of Red Lake. So we can choose those areas very carefully. So we would keep that spirit here with these aquatic invasive species check stations. We wouldn't be setting up a check station on 35 south of Moose Lake at the rest area and having every vehicle coming down 35 come in there. We would more than likely pick a location and work with the county attorney. Our policy currently is, before we can do a game and fish checkpoint, is that we have to get approval from the county attorney, who's the prosecuting authority for anything that might come up. We would utilize these check stations in much the same manner. It would be somewhere possibly from an infested body of water where there's very limited access to the road that the people be coming down, other than where they would be coming from the lake. So the probability of somebody coming from the lake would be extremely high, rather than the 35 Interstate 35 scenario where they could be coming from Grandma's house and it has nothing to do with gaming.
Thank you, Major.
Yes.
Continue, Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Major and Dr. Skinner. I've got a lot of questions around this ability for law enforcement to apprehend or stop people. Even it sounds like there's even the opportunity, according to the recent testimony, at places that are not close to the boat launch. Subdivision 1 that we just went over allows you to refuse somebody access to the boat launch if they refuse to allow you to inspect their vehicle and or boat or other accessories. Do you then have the ability to apprehend them and prevent them from moving somewhere else if they would like to go home or they would like to vacate the area somehow? Are they somehow subdued by DNR law enforcement because of their refusal to allow your inspection?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, what this would do in Section 1 would be, would allow the inspector to inspect the boat prior to it being launched. If the the individual says, I don't want you to inspect my boat before it's launched, they can prohibit that person from launching the boat. There's nothing in here that would allow for the impoundment of that boat, where they would seize the boat because you're not going to take it. They would just be told, go away, go home, you cannot launch this boat. And if they continue to launch that boat, I believe that's if it's in subdivision 2, if it's not a licensed peace officer, then that person could report that violation to a licensed peace officer, and that individual be issued some type of citation, more than likely, or civil citation. So the only impoundment or confiscation of equipment is, I believe, where I can't, do you know where it is right up hand? It's there's a subset in here where if there's some water-related equipment that's already been placed into the water that has some type of aquatic invasive species on it, that it can be confined to that area until it can be removed from the body of water. So, for an example, if a large swimming platform was placed in the water and it had zebra mussels on it, law enforcement could confine it to that spot. You can't move that anywhere until you pull it out of the water or until you clean it. So it would be more of a containment, don't move it anywhere. Another example would be, let's say there's a large watercraft that's trucked in on a semi to Lake Minnetonka, for example, and they have to use a crane to get that behemoth into the water. And once they get it into the water, we see it on the water line that there's zebra mussels attached to it. Well, it's not as easy to just pull it out like a regular boat. We would confine that watercraft to the dock until it could be removed, or the zebra mussels removed, or whatever is infested with it. And Dr. Skinner found that area on Section 12, and I believe we already kind of went through that.
Yeah, Section 12 and Section 13, and Mr. Chairman, that's
Dr. Skinner.
That's already in statute right now.
Current statute. Representative Jaskowski, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Major Smith. Is it? As I look in Subdivision 2, lines 7.17 through 7.19, I see similar language there. Individual who's doing the inspections could contact a conservation officer or other licensed peace officer, and help me understand how that relates to my earlier question. Again, it says, or stopped at any other location in the state of the officer determines there is reason to believe the aquatic invasive species, aquatic macrophytes, or other water present on the watercraft or water-related equipment. That's only if they, so at that point they have determined that it's already a conclusion that that there is invasive species in that particular equipment. It's not for a reason of refusal to allow inspection.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, if you look at line 711, well, actually 7-9. Inspectors may visually and tactically inspect watercraft and water-related equipment to determine whether aquatic invasive species, aquatic macrophytes, or water is present. And then it continues, if a person transporting refuses to take required corrective actions or fails to comply with the order under 84D10 sub 3, an inspector who's not a licensed peace officer shall refer the violation to the CO or licensed peace officer. So if they submit to the inspection and if they find bad things, they can be referred to the conservation officer and prohibited from launching in. Or if they come to the body of water and refuse to have inspection under subdivision 1, I believe, then they would be turned away and say you can't launch. And if they do launch and fail to submit to the inspection, then they could also be referred to a peace officer for corrective action.
Thank you. Any more follow-up? Representative Jaskowski?
No, not at this point.
Representative Anderson? Thanks, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself and following up on Representative Jaskowski, but I see nothing here about decontamination. If they do find material
what about getting rid of it, the high-pressure washing, or how are we going to handle that part of it if they do find material?
Dr. Skinner, is that later in the bill, or is that really, do you address decontamination potential sites? Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it's actually in a definition of inspect. And it can be, and I can, I'll go right back to it for you. And it's actually on the first page in, on Section 2. Inspect means to examine water-related equipment to determine whether aquatic invasive species, aquatic macrophytes, water is present and includes removal, drainage, decontamination, or treatment to prevent the transportation and spread of aquatic species, invasive species, aquatic macrophytes, etc.
Members, this is good discussion. We are going to keep moving ahead. We are going to pass this bill or take a vote on this bill today, and we need to hear from the public. But it's important for people to realize this has serious implications. The emphasis is on education, but people that don't listen need to know how serious this is when you talk about moving some of this stuff around. And it's a game changer in people's attitudes about this is serious stuff. I mean, we're talking about pulling people over and when they leave landings and having frank conversations with them when they got weeds hanging from their boat and they're like, well, what's the big deal? Well, talk to people on Ossawinamakee, Gull Lake, or Minnetonka, or on lakes that are nearby there, and they are very, very nervous, and they want to help, and they want to see what we can do to move forward. Representative Purcell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You actually just touched on what I was going to offer a response to Representative Draskowski on the 7.17 area, and that somebody with you know, cabbage weed or something on their boat would be what I would interpret that they would be likely be, you know, could be stopped and told to clean that off or whatever. But that was my read of that. I think you touched on that.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Dr. Skinner, continue. We do need to allow time for the testifier, so if you can wrap it up. I want you to hit on the significant changes. You have to do that. Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to be brief. We have three or four more that I'd like to touch base. The first one is Section 16, Service Provider Permits. This would require new training and permitting of lake service providers who move boats, docks, dock lifts, etc., for hire. And so make sure that they're trained to do the best management practice so they're cleaning their equipment. So this would require that they get a permit and that they're trained, and the license would be good for, the permit would be good for 3 years, and there would be a fee required for the training.
Dr. Skinner, how soon are you going to do this?
Mr. Chairman, we'll be ready to go right away this summer as soon as it's passed. We're already doing this type of training right now, and we just have to change it with whatever the current laws are and move forward.
Dr. Skinner, this is one of the reasons why this needs to be passed day after enactment. You need to work with these people immediately to get going on this. Continue, Dr. I'm sorry.
To that point,
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Skinner, Dr. Skinner, excuse me, are you planning to do regional education for these people that do these types of jobs, or are they going to have to come? How are you going to train them? How are they going to get the fees? Thank you.
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, right now we have eight planned right now without this legislation. So we're moving forward as an educational process right now. We will take this out to them around the state.
Dr. Skinner, is that going to happen before ice out?
Mr. Chairman, we are having one of the first trainings, I believe, is today. We had one yesterday. It was canceled due to weather. We would ramp these up right away. Part of the challenge, to let you know, is the risk. The main risk will be once the summer gets going, and for example, when zebra mussels are in the water column. So yes, getting them done in the spring would be important. But right now, first at ice out, when everyone's just putting things back in the lake, is not the highest risk. But as the summer goes on, the risk increases tremendously.
Continue, Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, the next sections I want to bring to your attention is regarding penalties. Starting in Section 18, in Subdivision 3, criminal penalties. Right now, most of the invasive species violations are criminal, are a misdemeanor or guilty of misdemeanor, and we want to extend this out through all of them just to include the transport of aquatic plants. This was in the Game and Fish Bill last year that was not passed, and so we want to include that so it makes it uniform across. Mr. Chairman, we also, in Section 19, want to clarify that civil citation authority applies to all water-related equipment with this new definition of water-related equipment. And continuing on, on Section 20, civil penalties. In this section, this would double most of the civil penalty amounts and also have higher fines for those who have, as Representative Dill was mentioning, who are continued to violate or repeat offenders. And so right now, most of these, if you look through them, range from anywhere from $50 up to $250, and those then would change from by doubling most of those penalties as increasing the current.
Representative Lagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading ahead, and this was a section that troubled me because I think we should be using civil penalties rather than criminal penalties. But I can't see any relationship between the penalties charged here and the harm incurred. So somebody can do an act that has tremendous consequences for the people who live on or enjoy a lake, and the value of their property can dramatically decrease. But somebody's paying $100. Big deal, frankly. I mean, how many cases of, it's really not a lot. But my biggest concern is down on lines 9.3031, where you have somebody who has multiple violations, you're just subject to twice the penalty amounts. It is those folks that we really need to be targeting, the kind of repeat offenders. That doesn't do much for the repeat offenders. I don't know how this particular twice the amount came up.
And either Dr. Skinner or Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Medius, some background that Dr. Skinner provided earlier in the session was that a lot of this came out of stakeholder meeting groups, and there was a wide spectrum of folks in those stakeholder meeting groups. And when we drafted all this legislation for you folks to consider, some people think that this is going to be too lenient. Some people think this is going to go too far. And when we got to the civil penalty portion in our work group at DNR, we knew this would be a charged issue. We knew that some folks would like to see a $10,000 fine. We know that some folks wanted to see a $100 fine. And we really weren't sure where to land. So in simplest, and maybe we're dodging the question, but what we did is we just simply doubled them, and we figured that maybe this body with some of the folks that want to testify would be able to help us target those dollar amounts in a little more.
And Major, that these are some of the reasons why this committee is going through the other committees it's going through, but this is good discussion in this committee, as this is the Environment Committee and this is an environment issue. Representative Lagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an environment issue in that we pay the consequences out of this committee's bill for what we have, the consequences of this. So it is our jurisdiction to figure out what the relationship of these fines is going to be. And I am troubled by the small amount that somebody can pay and cost somebody else a ton of money. But the most troubling, and I hope members will be thinking about this, for repeat offenders, for the scufflaws among us, who aren't very many, but you know that there's some folks that say, you know what, I don't care. Twice is doubling the penalty, and it's no big deal. That's where we should be targeting our efforts. And I don't feel this is very targeted, and I would be interested in hearing what other members of the committee can.
Well, Representative Lagenius, this is a tough discussion, but we take away people's ATVs and we take away people's Suburbans if they shoot a trophy whitetail or destroy ATV, do destructive things. We're not proposing in here to take boats away, but we have to be really careful. This is new territory. We really want buy-in from the general public to take this seriously, and I think they've had significant discussions with all the folks, and I don't think at this time we want to be proposing for multi-offenders, which could be one little piece of grass or weed got left on their boat when they thought they got everyone around, and they thought the wife checked the back, and the husband thought, they thought each other checked the back of the boat, and the time before their son forgot to do it, and this is their second offense, and got a $30,000 bass boat that they're really trying to do the right thing, and so it's a tough issue. Representative Wiginius.
Well, there's a lot of difference between impounding somebody's boat and paying $200 for multiple offenses, and that's what we're talking about, $200.
Well, Representative Wiginius, it actually is in the statute that says we can double the fine. That's $500. So,
well, but
if I read it right, Major Smith, you can hit somebody $1,000. Major Smith, excuse me, Representative Wiginius.
But the cheaper one, for number one online 9/11, it's 100, so it doubled to 2.
Correct. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate your comments, Mr. Chair. We don't, however, fine people for having a rifle and ammunition in their vehicle when a deer happens to just trot across a road without the action of the person violating the law. I'm curious on 9.23 through 9.27. We are going to be changing the structure of the fine there from people who don't drain their bilge out when they are apparently leaving infested waters to one that, again, as we discussed earlier, we're going to fine them just for not having the plug in their, or not having the plug removed and their valves opened, etc. Even though the bilge may be completely dry, it appears we're still going to fine them even if the bilge is completely dry and the plug happens to be in the boat. And in the chance that it is redundant, I'd just like to make sure that that is the case, Mr. Chair.
Comment, Major Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, we'll have the opportunity to, but it doesn't mean we're going to. We would be able to, but it doesn't mean we're automatically going to write everybody a civil citation.
Continue, Dr. Skinner. Major Smith, were you done?
Yeah.
Thank you. Continue, Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, another piece that applies to civil penalties is we're also, that legislation proposes that for those fines or those civil citations written by local units of government, that they would retain the penalty proceeds from those. So right now they all go to the state. This way the local county or city who writes it could then retain those proceeds. Mr. Chairman,
I have no intentions of ever being a commissioner. Dr.
Yet.
Skinner, continue.
Mr. Chairman, as we move forward, going down to Section 24, this is one of those educational pieces, a required education piece, which would require a decal on all boats and all watercraft in the state. So it would have the invasive species rules and what you need to do to prevent the spread of invasive species, and it required that that it must be attached in full view of the operator on the boat. This is something that's currently done for personal watercraft around those laws, and this would be something new that we would ask for all watercraft of the state. Mr. Chairman, as we move forward, we go on to Section 26. This is a little bit of a change now. We've been talking all about prevention up until this point, but there's 2 points in here regarding invasive aquatic plant management. In this section, it would actually define a new permit, which is the invasive aquatic plant management permit, which is a lake-wide control for selective control lake-wide for aquatic invasive species. And it would also, in this section, allow the opportunity for, right now, if you're doing lake-wide control up near the shore, you have to get the signatures of every homeowner around the lake. And if you look at a lake like Detroit Lakes, where they have 850 homeowners around that, it's an undue burden in many cases. This would actually provide alternative ways to notify folks and have be able to get that that authority, other than just a signature for every one of those, to do those large treatments. And third, it would also allow, if they do get signatures, that they would actually last for up to 3 years. And one last point just above that in Section 25 at the end, the current aquatic plant management permits through the current APM rule only are allowed up through August 31st or September 1st. We just want to extend that out to the end of the year because there's a lot of management that ongoes in the fall. We want to make that it's available through the whole open water season. With that, Mr. Chairman, concluded.
Thank you, Dr. Skinner. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Skinner, how are these permits or stickers paid for, and what are the consequences for not displaying them?
Dr. Skinner or Major Smith?
I'm sorry, Section 24.
Section 24.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gostolski, I'll speak to the I won't speak to how they're paid for. I'll let Dr. Skinner do that. But they are they're modeled after the personal watercraft. Folks that were around in the late 90s, they were pretty much considered an invasive species on many lakes with poor operation. And we ended up using the sticker that had to be in plain view of the operator because to tell them the rules of what they can and can't do while operating their personal watercraft. And we think that worked well because it was we've had some discussion about making people who register watercraft take some invasive species training in order to register their license, in order to register their watercraft. We found that there's some Coast Guard regulations that would prohibit tying the registration of a watercraft to the taking invasive species training. And I'll give an example. My family, we own three boats. They're all registered in my dad's name. And my dad doesn't drive all three boats. So, you know, are you really hitting the target audience? Well, we need to hit the people that are actually operating the boat. And so we figured if we had something that was in full view of the operator, much like this personal watercraft thing that had the rules, that would probably be a little bit better of an educational tool than having the boat owner taking a test that probably won't relay the information to those people actually operating it. So Section 24 talks about that. If you look at Section 27, the temporary warning requirements, a violation of Section 24 shall not be result in a penalty but is punishable only by a warning until July 1st of 2012. So we're giving folks a whole year of warnings to do that. So,
Dr. Skinner, any further comment? I got to keep them short because I got to let these people testify.
Mr. Chairman, we would use funding from our current program dollars that we use for communication or public education to pay for this portion. For these.
Dr. Skinner, do you have an estimated cost for the program?
Mr. Chairman, we estimate, we looked at it, we're talking about 800,000 boats in the state plus out-of-state voters that come in to purchase about a million stickers. At about 5 cents a sticker, would be about $50,000 for purchase, and then probably about that much again to make sure we distribute it all across the state to every boat, bait dealers and boat dealers and everyone around the state.
Thank you, Dr. Skinner. Follow-up, Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, quickly, thank you. The decal, after July 1st of 2012, it's no longer a warning. At that point, then, is it a misdemeanor?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, I believe so, yes. I'd have to look at how 86B, because it's actually tucked in 86B 508, so I'd have to look at the penalty provisions.
Can one of the pages come here and get that book for Major Smith? Representative Hackbart, or Representative Draskowski, are you done?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Yep, Representative Hackbart.
I'll pass.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Real quickly, does the sticker requirement apply to all types of watercraft, including canoes, and does it apply to like a resort who has a pile of canoes and boats that go in and out of the same lake?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, yes, all boats.
Major Smith, are you already there? Representative Hackbart, do you want to ask your question while the major is getting Draskowski's answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to pass, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit about how people get these stickers. I mean, boats are registered, what, every 3 years or something like that? How are we going to get the sticker? Are you going to mail them out to every registered boat owner? How are we going to get the stickers?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd start by getting them to all the dealers all across the state. We'd provide them to to any outlet that's selling licenses. We try to get them out to all the DNR offices, our watercraft inspectors, we have them. We have not discussed setting them out to all registered boaters by mail at this point, partly because of costs. We're trying to get them out across the state so they're available to anywhere people get their fishing license or they get their registration or anywhere their regulations, they can pick up one of these stickers.
Representative Hackbart?
That's it.
Okay, thank you. We've got Major Smith to Representative Jaskowski's question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Judge Kelsey, it would be a misdemeanor.
Okay, thank you. We have Barb Halbachen, if you could come down. Then I have Henry Erdman and Tara Gooder. I apologize if I... Is there anybody else that wanted to testify? Could you raise your hand at this time as we try to allow enough time? Okay, Lance, four, so we have one more. Okay, we're going to ask you to just talk for a couple minutes. We've heard from the DNR. I want to give all four of you enough time. So if you could hold your testimony to only 2 minutes, and I'm going to require that. I know you have good things to say, but short and concise in your 2 minutes, it'll allow a couple time, a little bit of time for questions, and we want to pass this bill today, or at least take a vote on passing this bill. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barb Halbach of Fishburg. In January of this year, I was the main architect of a Tri-County Aquatic Invasive Species Legislative Seminar, and we collaborated with the City of Detroit Lakes, the Pelican River Watershed, Becker County Commissioners, businesses, and members of the community to put together a presentation for over 300 people. And we had 8 legislators that represented Becker County, Hubbard County, and Otter Tail County. And we presented to them what the invasion of aquatic invasive species meant to our lakes country in terms of the devastation that it could cause to how we manage our community and how dependent we are on healthy lakes. And we are very pleased to have this bill come before us, and we appreciate your thoughtfulness in hearing this and understanding the urgency of getting this bill to the agency so that they may implement the things that are needed to as quickly as possible for ICE out this year. We look forward to working with the agency and strengthening this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halbach. Any questions for her? I see none. We'll move on to Henry Erdman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Henry Erdman. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. We're a group of cabin owners and lakeshore owners statewide. We'd like to thank the agency for bringing this bill forward. It's an important first step in addressing what is a problematic situation in the state of Minnesota concerning our waters. Also want to thank the committee for their time and careful deliberations on this effort. We are working with the department to address how we can maybe make this bill a little bit better and more effective, and we will continue those discussions going into the future as this bill progresses through the system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Erdman? Seeing none, we'll move on to Tara
Getter.
Thank you so much. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Tara Getter. I'm the administrator of the Pelican River Watershed District up in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota area. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we definitely support this bill. A couple of things I'm going to point out. We definitely want to get this passed before the opening fishing season. We are, in fact, I think I just heard about the professional lake service provider training. We're holding one next Tuesday in Detroit Lakes, and my office in particular, in addition to the notices that the DNR sent out, our office also sent out letters encouraging the lake service providers to attend the training, and it's not mandatory, but we sent out a flyer showing what the zebra mussel impacts are, along with a press release that the DNR issued regarding this piece of legislation that this may be a requirement, so we're trying to urge them to do that. And the Becker County Coalition of Lake Associations sponsored that as well. And we're making phone calls, encouraging everybody to attend that session, including my staff at my office. We have a very extensive monitoring program. We take our boats lake to lake, and we have multi-probe monitoring equipment, and we also have to figure out what we're going to do in addition to the fishing communities. There hasn't even been a lot of talk about that. Agencies who do monitoring work, how are we going to be decontaminating our equipment? So that's a big issue. The signature card requirements, we worked real hard on that last year on a rules change, but unfortunately that did not get enacted upon. We do extensive treatments on three lakes. The signature card was definitely onerous for us. It's not just a matter of getting signature cards. We were required to get 850 signature cards. And so the process is you have to pay for a lake delineation of where that aquatic invasive species is located. So you're on the boat. You have to map it out using GIS. Then you have to cross-check with the auditor's office for all those signature addresses. So we have to meld. If we didn't have GIS, I tell you, we could not have done it. There's no way to do this door-to-door because we have many seasonal people. The costs involved, it took weeks to get this stuff done. So I am very pleased to see that there's an alternative mechanism for us to enable to do lake-wide treatments for aquatic invasive species.
Thank you. Ms. Gooder, a question? Thank you. Next we have, appreciate you coming down and testifying. Mr. Erdman. Oh, boy, you guys are rolling. I should step out again. Mr. Ness, you might, no other citizens here that want to testify for or against the bill. Folks, if you came here to listen, you got something to say, we still have time. Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, president of the Fish and Wildlife Alliance and president of Anglers for Habitat. Vern Wagner was here just before me and testified we're in support of the bill. I just want the committee to be aware of a couple of the actions we are taking. We are trying to raise approximately $500,000 at this point to do a public education awareness campaign. We think that this is critical to the stopping the spread of invasive species. It has to be done publicly. The public has to be made aware of this. They have to make it what we call learned behavior. Just like buckling up your seatbelt, we need people to start cleaning their boats, being conscious of the fact that they can transport these exotic species from spot to spot. And the greatest threats right now to fishing are coming through the water, whether it's VHS in the Duluth Harbor, whether it's Asian carp coming up the Mississippi River, or whether it's zebra mussels and quagga mussels being transferred from lake to lake. The public has to help. They have to be educated. They have to be knowledgeable of what's going on. They have to understand that there are serious repercussions that will affect us all. So we're going to do a public awareness campaign. Estimated right now we have an RFP out to about $500,000. So that's what we are working on, and we want to make the committee aware of that as well. We support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Are there any questions for Mr. Ness? I see none.
Representative Purcell, any final comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion, and I'm just... firmly believe we need to move this forward, and I appreciate that you stated at the beginning that this may come back to us, and sounds like we may need to revisit some things, but I just thank everybody for their participation and good questions, and ask you to support the bill.
All those in favor of House File 1162 say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion carries. Members, next week we are going to hear from Representative Hackbart's going to be working on the game and fish stuff. I believe Representative Fabian has the lands bill. So we're going to move into some policy stuff from this point going forward. I think we'll probably do game and fish stuff, Representative Hackbart, first. So we'll begin with that Tuesday. A number of you have bills that are related to that. I think Ms. Rudolph knows which ones have requested hearing requests. If you've got a bill and you haven't requested a hearing request and you want the bill heard, or one of your colleagues do, they need to let Ms. Rudolph know they want the hearing heard. Any other things before the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. As long as we have a couple minutes extra here, I'd like to ask Dr. Skinner a question if he's still...
Dr. Skinner.
And I guess my question has to do with zebra mussels being found on some very busy and popular lakes, what he thinks about the odds of it having spread to other lakes, or how do you know if another lake gets it, the water tests, or is it just somebody sees a zebra mussel laying on the shore? How do you know if a lake is infested?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, most of the time when we find zebra mussels, we find adults. You can do water. Villagers are in the water, but typically when the population is extremely low, it's really hard to detect them by doing, you know, taking water samples. So most of the time we do it by searching shorelines, and most of them are found by incidental sightings by lake homeowners, that they find one washed up on their beach. And, for example, Lake Minnetonka last year, one zebra mussel was found in one area, and we spent 2 days to find a couple more. And then after a while, we started to find them, but it took quite a bit of time. So it really takes the visual to find that first one. Typically, when you find zebra mussels in a lake, that means they've been there, especially adults, it means they've been there for at least a year, maybe two, prior to finding. So there's always a time lag by the time you find an adult in the lake and how long they've actually been in the water.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.